This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report produced by Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg, and I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash, and later on Building Bridges, Taxi Workers Alliance to join the New York City Central Labor Council.
But first, day laborers just won a big victory when a federal judge found that the village of Mamaroneck discriminated against them based on race. The court found that the village's actions, including fining contractors attempting to hire day laborers, closing a hiring site, and increasing police patrols in an area where they congregated, were motivated, at least in part, by race. We're joined by Alan Levine, attorney for the day laborers, and it's very much a pleasure to have you. Hooray, hooray, we won, we won, we won.
Thank you so much, Mimi.
Are you surprised? I'm always a little surprised. I'm a bit concerned about the federal courts these days, and there has been such a vicious backlash against immigrant workers that, again, I can't help but say, hooray, hooray, and a little bit of surprise.
Not totally. Anytime one finds a judge ruling on behalf of oppressed people versus their oppressors, one's always a little bit surprised. But Judge McMahon seemed to get it from the very beginning, from the first time we came into court. And that time we were simply arguing that day laborers had a First Amendment right to solicit employment on the streets of Mamaroneck when the police were doing everything to drive them off the streets. When we told her what was going on, she said, "It sure sounds like an equal protection case to me." And eventually, that was the focus of our case. And in fact, we dropped the First Amendment case. And the evidence was overwhelmingly clear that what the village had sought to do was, through police actions, both against the day laborers as well as the contractors who were there to give them jobs, was engaged in a campaign to drive the workers out of Mamaroneck. Now, you have to understand, Mamaroneck is a place that has had a day laborer population, an immigrant population, but including a day labor population for 50 or 60 years. It was an Italian community, or a substantial Italian immigrant community, around the beginning of the 30s, 40s, 50s. And there was testimony that many of them used to gather on the streets near Columbus Park, which is eventually where our clients gathered. And they'd wait there to get employment as workers for contractors. All that began to change in the 90s when the day laborers became a largely Latino population. And from that time on, the workers were moved from one place to another, always with charges that they were urinating in the streets or defecating or exposing themselves or harassing women who walked by. And it's the same thing one heard in the 90s. It's the same thing one heard in this case. And in fact, it's what is said about day laborers around the country. Same kinds of stereotypical anti-Latino prejudice. And Judge McMahon understood it. It helped that the mayor of the village made it clear that he thought there were too many day laborers in town and boasted about a campaign of law enforcement that in the period of a month resulted in a couple of hundred tickets, tenfold what they usually issued in a month, all issued around the Columbus Park area. And the consequence of that was that, of course, the contractors started staying away from the area and the day laborers began to leave Columbus Park. And the mayor boasted that the numbers of day laborers went down from 240 down to 40 inside of a month. So all of that together at least presented enough evidence for a sympathetic judge to grab onto. And I think this seriously offended her. Her opinion is just filled with that kind of controlled anger at what the village did.
I thought it was a very well-crafted decision, a 70-page decision, which is always gratifying for an attorney to get.
And filled with passion. This is an unusual day labor case. There have been a number around the country, and almost all the others have been First Amendment cases, that is, villages, municipalities.
Yeah, I did want to ask you about why that wasn't a fundamental issue within this.
Well, she raised a very provocative question at the very beginning. She said, are some of your clients undocumented? We said some of them may well be. She said, well, if they're undocumented, do they have a First Amendment right to solicit employment, given the fact that as undocumented workers, they don't have a right to work in this country? They don't have the appropriate papers. And we argued that it's not illegal to work. We've made a number of different arguments, and she understood. But she said, well, eventually I'm going to want to have everybody who is a plaintiff in this case disclose whether or not they're documented. And then I'll rule whether or not undocumented workers have a First Amendment right to solicit employment when that may be an illegal transaction. And as we came to the eve of trial, we made the decision, after lengthy consultation with our clients, it was really their decision, that they could not get up on the witness stand and disclose whether or not they were documented. We could not have the undocumented workers withdraw from the case and just have the documented workers, because that would have revealed to everybody that those we had removed from the case were undocumented. So we simply withdrew the First Amendment claim and proceeded as an equal protection claim. And in some ways, it turned out to be a blessing, because from a pure claim of constitutional rights, you're standing on the streets, do you have a First Amendment right to be there, which would not have been a fact-intensive case, it turned into a very fact-intensive case, because our obligation was to show that the workers were being treated differently from other people on the streets of Mamaroneck. And it obliged us to deal with what Judge McMahon found was an utter pretext, that is, the claims that all these enforcement activities that the village was engaged in were prompted by concerns about quality of life. And the evidence showed that to be the pretext that it was, and she found it.
It was important that in the context of the decision that it was demonstrated that there wasn't even an arguable relationship between the activities undertaken by the police during the period and controlling what they would call the quality of life. Certainly some of the hysterical arguments that had been raised by residents were that there were violations of public decency in effect, and quality of life issues raised their ugly heads and were very, very obviously a maneuver that in no way was justified.
Well, when you make things up as you go, it turns around to bite you at
By
some
any
point.
Means necessary,
well,
rationalizations and
well,
justifications
exactly.
of discrimination?
Look, the behavior that the village exhibited was so patently discriminatory. They had to come up with a rationalization. They also had to turn sentiment in the town against the workers. And so they talked about urinating, defecating, harassing women, bothering commuters, etc. The problem is that they have police complaint logs, which record every complaint made to the police. And we got those logs for a period of 6 months, and there was nothing about that. None of the logs indicated any of the complaints about the workers doing the things that they were alleged to have done. And then they brought police down there where the workers were gathered in Columbus Park, actually a parking lot in Columbus Park. And they kept a patrol car there every single day for a year and a half, 17 months, that the workers were down in that parking lot. And they said it was because of crime in the area. Except the police cars left at 11 o'clock when the workers left, and they didn't come on Saturdays or Sundays when the workers weren't there. So those contradictions are the kinds of things that Judge McMahon saw through very clearly and led her to say they dreamed all this up.
Well, this really sought to establish how far communities can go to rein in day laborers without violating their rights. So the question is, this is the third legal victory of this year of this sort. Does this send a clear message to local governments around the country that day laborers have rights and that municipal governments must not ignore these rights, lest they be held responsible?
Well, on the whole, municipalities have been losing these cases, but their tactics have changed somewhat, and they did in Mamaroneck. They didn't pass an ordinance. The ordinances that have been passed, or the prohibitions against day laborers in the streets, have largely been struck down on First Amendment grounds. And so communities have turned towards these pretexts. We're only getting rid of these people, keeping them off the streets because they are the focus of criminal activity. And so the importance of Judge McMahon's decision is that she pierced that. She looked through it and said, it's all nonsense. And my hope is that this will embolden others to challenge these kinds of rationales for getting rid of day laborers.
Now, you said something I have been aware of the victories, maybe because I chose to be aware of those, but you're saying that all over the country we've actually had significant setbacks.
Well, there have been victories almost consistently on First Amendment grounds. Whenever communities have passed ordinances that bar day laborers from soliciting employment, almost uniformly courts have struck them down. And so the tactics have turned towards the kinds of things that Mamaroneck has done. None of those have gone to trial until this case. And so this is the first time that a judge has been called upon to take a look at the evidence and be able to say, no, this is all pretext.
Now, the judge has also given a 10-day period to come back with some solutions to, quote-unquote, the problem, which would seem to be as obvious but would be rejected by the town more likely than not, or maybe they won't at this juncture, and that is really a hiring center.
The village has called us, and they want to sit down and talk, and my assumption is that they want to avoid the kind of order that federal judges frequently give in these kinds of cases, which will be monitoring supervised by the plaintiffs and their lawyers over a period of time to ensure that the police are not behaving in a discriminatory way. My assumption is they would prefer not to have such an order issued, and we're prepared to consider less strenuous court supervision in exchange for some showing by the village that they're willing to make life better for day laborers, including giving them a place where they can gather for work and a place where they can learn some skills, take English language classes. That's been done in communities around the country. And there's a new administration in Mamaroneck. The worst of the anti-immigrant people were rejected at the last election. And so,
does that also include our local trustee who referred to people and the immigrant population as locusts?
As locusts. He's gone, and the leader of the community near Columbus Park, who is the most outspokenly hostile person in the village to the day laborers, he ran for election and he was rejected. So our hope is that maybe this new council will be more receptive to a less confrontational approach.
Indeed, and maybe there can be the time and energy to begin to deal with the stereotypes and the claims and comments both of public officials and individuals in the community that really are completely at odds with the reality that immigrant workers are crucial to our economy, that they build this country, they always have, and but for the indigenous people and those who were brought here, catapulted by slavery, immigrants create the wealth of this country.
Well, training and education are often part of the orders that follow this kind of judicial finding, and those are some of the things that we would be asking for as well. Training of members of the police force, community relations kinds of activities.
Well, Alan Levine, congratulations for the great effort on behalf of the day laborers in Mamaroneck, and as far as I'm concerned, on behalf of all people who seek social justice.
Thank you so much, Mimi.
It's been a pleasure. I've been speaking with attorney Alan Levine. Thank you.
Taxi Workers Alliance to join New York City's Central Labor Council.
Oh, yes. While not defined as employees under the law, the 26,000 mostly immigrant taxi drivers in New York City have the same problem as other workers, such that taxis are often called sweatshops on wheels, and they have the same solution, solidarity. They have joined hands for many years in the Taxi Workers Alliance, which has been a militant advocate for their rights. Now the New York City Central Labor Council has reached out to them, and the Taxi Workers Alliance plans to affiliate with the Central Labor Body, realizing that the greater their solidarity, the greater their strength.
And we're joined by Betty V. Desai, Executive Director, and Bill Lindauer, member of New York Taxi Workers Alliance.
Wow. So, is there something about this point of time, some receptivity on the part of the Central Labor Council that has recognized, particularly given the stupidity, the National Labor Relations Act, which doesn't recognize the right of you folks to unionize, etc.? So tell us about the significance of this and why now?
Well, Ed Ott kind of being in the leadership now was definitely what closed the deal for us. You know, he's a longtime advocate of workers and a real people's hero, and we wanted to be in an organization where he's in the leadership. What this will mean for Taxi Workers Alliance and the taxi drivers of New York City is that we will basically have more muscle at the table. The CLC is the umbrella organization of New York's labor movement. They have 1.5 million members. We want to bring that type of support and solidarity and allies that says that the organization that fights for the rights of transit workers and teachers will support the rights of taxi drivers.
You'll be the first of hopefully in the future many organizations like yours to affiliate with Central Labor Council.
That's right. As Mimi was saying, because under the NLRB and, well, we know who's in power at the federal governments. What do they really know, right, about anything? You know, according to the NLRB.
Ah, you independent contractors, why should you have
to cut the legs out from under
you
us?
You have no right to organize. You're contractors. You're not workers.
Yeah, then they made you contractor because it used to be different.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, they know a lot.
Well, yeah, that's true. They know how to fight for the power
exactly.
for the bosses. So under the NLRB, drivers are independent contractors, and we don't have the same right to a collective bargaining agent, right, which in its very strict legal sense is what a union is. We've always seen ourselves as a union. Taxi drivers are working people, and the role of the union is to defend the rights and fight for the power of working people, and that's what we do. So we are the first organization that's not a collective bargaining agent to join the CLC, any CLC throughout the country.
That is very exciting, and we'll find out more why. Now, Bill,
yes.
You're a driver.
Yes, I am.
How many millions of years?
30 plus.
Whoa.
You're
going to
say how many millions of miles.
Well, that too. I can imagine. Why, you want to take a guess?
I would guess. I wish I could get frequent driver miles.
Well, I mean, I really remember the industry way back went from taxi rank and file coalition to this incredible manifestation. One of the things about Taxi Workers Alliance is it's indicative of many, not just, but many immigrant-based industries that are using creative forms to organize. So, Bill, what is your role and what is your thoughts about this? And, of course, we described taxi cabs as, what, sweatshops on wheels? How far wrong or right are we?
You are correct. It is a sweatshop on wheels. And for a long time, it was the bosses, the fleets and the brokers that had all the power. But since we came on the scene, we changed that equation. And more power has gone to the drivers. And we intend to for even more power to go to the drivers so that drivers can make a decent living for themselves and their families for once. Cab rates in New York City are pretty damn low. You know, this is the most expensive city in America, but our cab rates are somewhere in the middle. And we just went to a conference in Seattle back in September. It's the International Association of Transportation Regulators, all the taxi people who oppress us. We wanted to monitor them so they wouldn't have too many oppressive policies. But in Seattle, the taxi rates include a gas surcharge of a dollar. Plus, if people over two, each pays 50 cents, of course, unless it's a child under 12.
I'm not sure everybody realizes that you are not the medallion owners. So I think you should just give a little for those people who may not understand the nature of the industry, what it means to kind of horse hire and what it means to lease those medallions. So what the costs are involved.
Well, the shifts are 12 hours. I'm a day driver, so I pay a little less than the night drivers. I pay $108, which includes some silly $3 state sales tax.
$108 per shift?
Per day. Plus, of course, I have to pay for my own gas. So that's a big, as they say on Broadway, that's a big nut, you know?
And what would you say you make, you know, you clear a day given that?
$80 to $100, which I cleared way back in the 1970s.
$80 to $100.
So we haven't gone really forward.
Right.
I remember the bosses, they submit their appeals for lease cap increases, the rates that we pay to rent the cab. So you don't see their books. These books are private, and we have every reason to suspect that they make windfall profits. The lion's share of every shift money goes to the owner. This is not right in 21st century enlightened America, is it?
Oh, how rhetorical. Hell no.
let's get back to the Central Labor Council. I mean, there's a lot of new stuff happening, but what do you think you're going to get out of this concretely? It's all very good to say solidarity, but what's the first thing you think you're going to get out of joining the Central Labor Council? What's the benefits?
Well, the main issue that we're going to be working on together is really health insurance for taxi drivers. We want to establish a health and benefits fund for health insurance, short-term disability compensation for time off. I mean, even if there's a family emergency or even if you've been injured in an accident, your lease is already paid for up front. There's no paid time off in this industry for the drivers. So we want to see a fund that will give that back to the workers. And also, we want to build a health and fitness center at the airport taxi lot at JFK. It's a huge parking lot. About 700 taxis are on hold there. Drivers have waiting times of between an hour and a half to 3 hours. And while they're there, we want our members to be able to access an exercise facility and physical therapy practice and a medical clinic, because they're really the two main barriers to health care for drivers are, one, the lack of time to be able to go to a facility, and then, of course, the lack of money to afford the insurance. So our main priority with the CLC is to stop the city's technology program that they want to impose on the workers right now, which would mean $5,400 and up to $175 a month to maintain a technology, which is primarily to track the taxis and the drivers. We don't need it.
Instead, you have to go back on that. I didn't quite catch what that meant.
Well,
technology to track the drivers.
The Taxi and Limousine Commission right now has a plan to install various technology in all the taxi cabs. Two main elements will be a monitor in the back seat for the passenger, and then a tracking software on the meter and the vehicle to really track the whereabouts of the drivers. And it'll also have a credit card and debit card reader attached to it. Now, all of this is going to cost $5,400 to buy and $175 per month to install. And this for a workforce that cannot even afford health insurance. So we want to change the priority of the regulators and the bosses in this industry, and we want the money to go toward health care for the drivers.
I understand that one of the other things, now we're talking roughly about people who make $27,000 to $33,000 a year and work 60 to 70 hours mm-hmm. a week. And, of course, and when you talk about health care, we're still living in a country where we know that there's at least 44 mm-hmm. million people who are uninsured. So that's incredible. But I also understand that there are some other things aside from the fitness center, which sounds fabulous, and that is issues of education.
Right.
And training and computer technology, other than that which is in the back, which sounds like Homeland Security got their fingers on that one. Tell us about that as well.
The Consortium for Worker Education is the education arm of the labor movement, and you know they're a worker school that works along with the CLC. So we'll be able to offer classes both for our members, the drivers, as well as their families, you know, at different times of the day that the members will be able to access for ESL, for writing, for computer skills, or even more mechanical skills to go along with the driving. And then school and the classes for their children as well, college preparatory classes and other sorts of programs like that.
Bill, the waiting time, the fare is going up for the waiting, it was being adjusted for the waiting time. Will that money go to the drivers, or is that money going to go to the owners?
TLC showed some wisdom for a change. All that money will go to the drivers, they say. There'll be no increase in the lease rates.
Whoa, okay.
How are they going to monitor? I mean, can they really monitor that?
Yes, they can, and we will make sure that the owners adhere to the letter of the law. Incidentally, back in 2004, when we asked for a fare hike, which was first in 8 years, we asked for a modest increase in the waiting time to $18 an hour. They ignored that. They don't think time is money in New York, apparently.
Well, your workers' time.
And so they doubled it on their own. And it would have been much more palatable to the public if they had, at that time, raised it to $18. Of course, it's barely in the 21st century as far as waiting time rates go, because most cities have a $24 an hour waiting time, while we had a $12 an hour waiting time. And a city like Seattle has a $30 an hour waiting time, as does other cities. Yeah.
Betty, what will this mean for you? Have a very large immigrant workforce. It's a low-income workforce and largely immigrant. What do you think this collaboration, this joining with the Central Labor Council means for their recognition, their understanding of the rights and the needs of immigrant workers?
I think it makes a statement that the labor movement recognizes that the workers that are on the margins of the labor market need to be at the center of the labor movement, and that the labor movement throughout history, workers will form whatever organization will, kind of best serve their interests and their needs. So whether we're considered a collective bargaining agent or not, the reality is that we're a legitimate organization. I think that increasingly the labor movement, both at the national level and at the local levels, is really beginning to recognize that, particularly after what happened after May Day and just the series of mass mobilizations from the immigrant community. There is no way that the labor movement can take a blind eye to that.
Yes, we always thought on May Day that the immigrant rights movement really reclaimed, brought May Day back home. Mm-hmm. Bill, what does all this mean for the workers on the ground? How do they look at this? Is it
mean the association with the
CLC? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure all workers appreciate what this means to all the cab drivers, but we're trying to inform them. That'll give us much more political clout. It may help us. I mean, the Central Labor Council has plenty of experience and wisdom and expertise and resources, and they could be a great help in setting up a health care fund or a health center, and of exercising political clout so we can defeat the tyranny of the GPS.
One of the most passionate, hardworking organizations who has proved their worth to their members. And congratulations on this affiliation. I think it's good for you, and I think it's great for the Central Labor Council. And Bill Lindauer and Betty Desai, it's been fabulous to have two people here from the Taxi Workers Alliance.
And this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.